For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so tonight we begin, as we have for the last couple of weeks, with a parable. And here's how it goes. Now, Jesus was also saying to the disciples, okay, again, the focus in this section of Luke is instructions to the disciples about what does it look like to really be a follower of me. And so he goes on and he says, there was a rich man who had a manager. And this manager was reported to have squandered his possessions. Not a very good manager. So he called him and he said, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, for you can no longer be my manager. So the manager said to himself, I'm fired. What shall I do since the master is taking the management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig and I'm too proud to beg. So this guy's in a real pickle. He says, now, here's what I'll do. So when I am removed from the management, people will welcome me into their homes. Here's my golden parachute, my plan B, whatever. So here's this plan. He summons each of his master's debtors and begins saying to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, well, I owe him 100 measures of oil. That's a lot of oil. And he said to him, okay, take your bill and write 50. Wow. And then he said to another, how much do you owe? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. So the manager said to him, take your bill and write 80. And so here is the parable of the cheating, conniving manager of money. And so Jesus is laying this out. And here's this guy. You just think about the situation. He's not a good manager. He's doing a bad job. He's not collecting what he needs to collect. And so now this has come to his owner's attention. And it's like, okay, now this guy's going to have to be fired. And so his response then is to go and basically extort money by having people change what they actually owe, their actual bill, so that when they present it to the master, the owner, they only have to pay a portion of what they really owe him. And so it's a bad idea. It's illegal. I'm sure there's a term for it. What's the term here? Some kind of extortion, I guess. I don't know. Fraud. Okay, that's easy. There you go. It's fraud. This is fraud. And so this bad idea, you're going to say, well, right, and Jesus is going to have definitely some things to say about this guy, right? And indeed he does. Here's what he says. And his master praised the unrighteous manager because he acted shrewdly. For the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light. This is one of the most surprising parables I think there is in the Gospels, because it just does not go the direction you think it's supposed to go. I mean, clearly there's something immoral going on, and the punchline Jesus has for it is like, you know, attaboy. We get something to learn from you, fraud committer guy. And so what we need to do is figure out what is it about this parable and about the behavior of this hypothetical manager that Jesus found to be praiseworthy. So let's just unpack it a little bit. The bottom line is, clearly, the reason why he's being praised is because he's shrewd. And so there is this principle then that Jesus is going to unpack as he explains the parable, which he's going to do in three fairly important principles that we'll get to in just a second, about what does it mean to be shrewd, because that's what this is about. That's why he's being congratulated. The shrewdness, however, of the unrighteous manager is being contrasted with the shrewdness that Jesus intends for his disciples. And this, if you've read through parables and the teaching of Jesus in general, in keeping really with the way that rabbis of Jesus' day often taught, He's drawing an analogy between a common example that people can relate to and then something that he's trying to help him to understand in a deeper way. That's what analogies are about. You take something that's known and you apply it to something that's less known. But the way that the analogy works is what people have called a fortiori argument. And it just follows the basic structure that you can see pretty clearly there. If X, how much more Y? In other words, if this unrighteous manager is to be praised for his shrewdness, how much more than you, my disciples, who are not like this guy at all, should be praised for the shrewdness that I'm calling you to? You see what I'm saying? If this totally immoral and irresponsible guy, which the manager is, there's no defense of that. He just puts it right out there. If this totally immoral and irresponsible guy shrewdly navigated his future, how much more astute must the spiritually minded disciple be? So it's important that we understand that this is not a parable where Jesus is trying to tell us that we should be cheaters and commit fraud. That's not the point of the parable. The point of the parable is that there is this shrewdness demonstrated by the manager, and that Jesus uses this as an example to say, well, look, if the owner could say, man, you know, you're still fired, but that was a good move. If the manager could say that of his own cheating manager, how much more then will God be impressed by or seek to develop in his disciples that kind of shrewdness? So let's talk about that a little bit. Let's unpack the specific illustration that's given here, and then we're going to walk through the application of this principle as Jesus lays it out for us. The lesson of the analogy, I think, is pretty straightforward when you think about it. Let's think about the elements of it. Here's a manager whose days are numbered. He's already been fired, right? So he's been given the pink slip. I guess he still has his key to the office or whatever. And so he can still connect with clients of his owner, of the owner of the thing. But no doubt the writing's on the wall. His days are numbered. It's going to be over for him. And so it is with us as disciples of Jesus Christ in this world. Our days are also numbered, right? We're not going to be around here forever. There's going to come a time where we get our pink slip, and then we're not going to be in the service of our master in this world anymore. And so with that in mind, now is the time to invest wisely in the future. And this is where the shrewdness really fits in. What does it mean, in other words, for us as disciples of Jesus Christ, living in a world in a temporary way, certain that we will be terminated at a certain point, and maybe that's weeks away, maybe that's years away, but it's coming. And so knowing that that's the case, what do we do? How do we build the resources that we have now? That's the point. And here, I think, is a point that many Christians get confused on right here. That we have, and I think, hugely in our culture, I think this is true worldwide and throughout history as well, because we're just humans after all. That we really tend to separate the material from the spiritual. And it's really difficult for us to think shrewdly about our resources. And so with the kind of a split between the spiritual and the physical, many of us in our culture think it doesn't really much matter what I do with my stuff, with my material possessions, because what really matters is the spiritual, right? And so what do people do with that then? They say, well, then I should just indulge my material aspirations to the extent that I'm able to do it, and if you're a good American, way more than that, so you can compile some debt as well. And that's sort of what we do. And there isn't very much really significant spiritual counsel given to how do we deal shrewdly with our assets. And I think that this is a passage that really brings this into focus in a very important way. In some cultures, unlike a very materialistic culture like our own, where we're pursuing our spirituality and it has nothing to do with our assets, in other cultures and other places, sometimes you find just the reverse, which is that yes, the spiritual and the physical are completely separated, but the physical is viewed as sort of an impediment to the spiritual. And so there's an ideal then of poverty, of having nothing, things like that. This would be much more of an Asian kind of outlook. But nonetheless, really integrating the world of the material and the world of the spiritual, and to do so in a shrewd way, is what this thing is really all about and the principles that he's going to get into. So let's just roll them out in turn. Verse 9, he says, I say to you, make friends for yourself by means of the wealth of unrighteousness, so that when it fails, they will receive you into eternal dwellings. So we're going from strange to stranger. What is he talking about here? What is this? Well, it's a call to generosity. That's really what it is. He makes two very important points of application in this verse in relation to this parable that he's given. The first is, just like this unrighteous manager, your wealth, our wealth, my wealth also will fail you. We have a finite amount of resources to use for a finite period of time. And at some point, it's no longer going to be in our possession, right? It's going to be in somebody else's possession. So it's going to fail you at a certain point. It's going to be over for you. And that has to be understood. You cannot take it with you. You forfeit it at a certain point. And secondly, what can I do then with the things that I have? And Jesus' advice is make friends for yourself with those assets that you have. Even though these are not spiritual assets, you wouldn't think of it in those terms because it's material things, it's money specifically. But even here, Jesus is like, there's not that radical separation between the things that are spiritual and the things that are material. And that indeed, you can use those financial assets and other kinds of personal assets that you have for the sake of friendship. That's an important point. Use your resources, which are not going to last, to make relationships that will never end. That's Jesus' suggestion right there. That's what it would be like to be a shrewd manager of your assets. That, you know, maintaining assets is all about quality investment, right? So, you know, if you've got money that you're squirreling away for retirement, you don't just stick it under your mattress. It's a bad idea. You want to invest that. Why? Because you want to make your money, what's the expression? Work for you, right? Work for you. And Jesus is like, yeah, that's kind of right. That's right. So what kind of investments can we make that we get the highest return on what we put in towards it? Well, how about this one? How about make friends for yourself by means of the wealth of unrighteousness? How about that? In this way, he says, so that when it does fail and you're done with your stewardship of that money, those people, those friends, will receive you into eternal dwellings. I really like Jim Elliot. He was a missionary to the Aka Indians in Ecuador a generation ago. He was killed by them and for going into their tribal regions and presenting the gospel. And yet he was a spiritual man, and he knew the kind of dangers that were involved with moving toward these pretty violent indigenous peoples. And he wrote shortly before his death a kind of a famous statement. He says, "He is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." Now think about that. He is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep. Can you keep your material assets? You cannot. Okay? You can't keep those things. And so you're not a fool if you give up those things to gain what you cannot lose. And what are those things that you cannot lose? What is the one thing that has no limits and that will not go away and that will endure forever? People. Your friends. And this is what the same thing that Paul really is getting at in Philippians chapter 4, verse 1. He says, "My beloved brothers and sisters, whom I long to see, my joy and my crown." Okay. Paul says, "I'm pouring my life out like a drink offering for the sake of your faith. Everything I've got is just nothing other than a thank offering to God for you." So he held claim to nothing. You know, God gave him lots of assets and lots of resources, but Paul always understood, well, these are things then to be given in the service of these people who he refers to here, not even as friends, but as brothers and sisters. And so we are. And so we are, no matter where we're from. No matter what the world says makes you different than anybody else, in the family of God, we are brothers and sisters. And as we direct our assets to the family of God, as Paul has done and as Jesus is here suggesting, something happens in our hearts. Something we're changed by that. And he says, of the brothers and sisters, he says, "whom I long to see, my joy and my crown." And so it's just like, you know, you can spend all kinds of money on yourself and all of your assets to satisfy whatever interests or desires you have. That's the narrative of our culture. That's what you're supposed to do, right? Yes. The answer is yes to that. Okay. And how satisfying is it? Where's the joy there? The joy's not there. The reality is that this is a serious problem. We seek satisfaction through the acquisition of things, the meeting of the many desires that are created in our hearts through just looking around at the things that other people have and now realize we can't live without. And we go out and get them, and it's never enough, and it's never enough, and it's never enough, and it's never enough. And we are a desperately discontented population. Tragically so. On the other hand, to take Jesus' advice, which Paul clearly does here, and says what's important is that I use those assets and invest them in the things that really matter, which is that what God is doing among his people, then you begin to connect with, because you have a stake in the sweet things that God is doing in your community and indeed globally as well. And the result of that is joy, a sense of deep satisfaction that we're going to come to a time where we're going to be sitting around this big banquet table, we're told in the scriptures. And there's going to be those moments where we get that little nudge on the side. "Hey, brother, yeah, let me tell you, I'm really glad to be around this table. And I wouldn't have if you hadn't used your resources to mobilize the person who talked to me about Christ." Okay. And that's what he says, "my joy and my crown of exaltation." What is our reward? Our reward is that awesome moment to be standing in the presence of God, knowing that others that we have loved and cared for are in the presence of God as well, because because we moved forward, we moved towards them with the things that God had given to us. That's the core of our value system as believers in Jesus Christ. That's what that is. Well, let's move on. In verse 10, Jesus says, "He who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much, and he who is unrighteous in very little things is unrighteous also in much. Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous wealth, who will entrust you with the true riches? And if you have not been faithful in the use of that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own?" And so here's this other principle, the principle of faithfulness, that we have been entrusted with true riches. And this then requires a bit of a transition in how we think about wealth in our day. We say, "I have wealth." Why? Because I've earned it. I got it the old-fashioned way, right? And whose is it? It's mine. We're fed that line from the very beginning. And there is a shade of truth in it, but it's only a shade of truth. Because the real truth is not that we're owners of anything, but that we are the stewards of God's resources, that He is the true owner. Psalm 24, verse 1, the earth is the Lord's and all that it contains. Who is the owner of all things? It's God. And for a window of time, just as this parable that Jesus is describing to us suggests, we have some management responsibility over these things that God owns. And so, Paul says, 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 1 and 2, "Let others regard us in this manner as servants of Christ, as stewards of the mysteries of God." Okay? And in this case, he says, moreover, "it is required of stewards that one be found trustworthy." So being faithful is the principle that Jesus is describing. That's the application that he brings us to as his readers. It's the same thing that you see in Paul and in the people of God as the implications of the Christian message are being lived out in the life and the experience of these early disciples. So the question that we want to ask is this: what are the things you've been entrusted with? Well, you say to yourself, not much. You say to yourself, I'm barely getting by on the financial, and on the personal end, you know, I'm charismatically impaired. I'm, you know, socially impaired. What do we do? We just kind of, we back away from the ownership of what we truly have been given by a gracious God. Whenever we say crappy stuff about ourselves, what are we saying? We disgrace our Maker. And we say to Him, "You didn't make me right." That's, you know, I think about that a lot. I'm prone to sort of a strong hint of negativity about myself. Some of you may know that about me. People who know me well know that that's not true. That's completely true. Reason. And I'm saying the ability to check my thinking, and to, when you get into these self-disparaging moments and where you maybe you compare yourself to others more gifted in various areas and conclude that you just don't have that much to offer or whatever. What a lie that is. What an ungrateful distortion of the goodness of God. This is really a theological problem. This is a relational problem that we're having with God. We maybe collapse into sort of a self-pity mode because, you know, I know how I suck and this kind of thing. And God's like, you know what? Whoa. We're asking the wrong question here. The real question is, what are the things that I've given you, the good things that you have, and that which I have given to you as a trust to use, to manage for my sake. We all have some things. We have significant things. And what I want to suggest here as well is that with these things that God has given to us, that in our honest moments that we recognize these things are really there. Intellectual gifts, financial assets, elements of our personality, our jobs, all of the things that we have lean on and which we value for our life, these all are gifts of God to us. And the question is, what would it look like to set goals in this area of asset management, goals, and then follow through with them? What financial manager would you trust if you said, hey man, so I'm going to be retiring in 30 years, or in my case, it's probably less than that. And so I have this amount of money each month, and it's going to be set aside for retirement, and especially for my wife who's going to live to be 190. And my dad died when he was 67, so there's kind of a disparity there. I want to provide for her. I want to make sure that that's covered. And what can you do to help me get from where I am to where I need to be for those commitments that I have? And for the manager to say, I don't know, just give it to me and I'll stick it somewhere. Right? How does that sound? Sound pretty good? Smart? Wise? I'm thinking about starting a business. What do you think? You'd say, well, if you don't have a plan, you're not worthy to manage my assets, right? Wouldn't we say that? We would certainly say that. Well, how is it then that we can be so deliberate about our financial future, for instance? About our career advancements, about the things that are tangible and that are right in front of us and the things that we're excited about. And miss the fact that the most important thing in the universe has gone on without any kind of forethought or goal setting or any criteria whatsoever to help us know, am I moving toward a point that would glorify my Lord? That is the issue being raised here. If we are entrusted with something, it means that we take stock of what we have, and it means that we are thinking in a creative and prayerful way about what does it look like then to really take these assets and make them work. And this is something that we need to talk about. This is a big deal that so many of us, we're largely in a demographic here tonight. We just can't kid ourselves. The reality is we are upper middle class. The net worth around in this room tonight is, in the hundreds of millions or tens of millions at least. And if we are like the rest of our society, we are advancing and we're very careful and thoughtful about these things. But where are we in relation to the things that really matter? And if there is a disconnect in your life in this area, as I know that is the case with so many of us here tonight, then we really need to think through the implications of Jesus's parable about what does it mean to be a shrewd disciple. And so to minister to that process, I want to suggest some things. Financial giving. That's clearly at the heart of what Jesus is describing here. And we don't talk about money easily in our culture. People don't know what each other makes, and which is fine. I'm not trying to argue that. But even in an earlier generation, spouses didn't even know what their husbands usually were making. It's kind of crazy. We got this code of silence about the thing. I wonder if that's there because it absolves us of accountability in this area. That would be my view. And we had an experience, my wife and I, very early on in our marriage. I've shared this a couple of times before over the years, but it's relevant here. In the area of finances, when we were in Chicago and I was a graduate student, and we didn't make a lot of money. And but we were hanging with people who had a real different attitude about money than we had ever been exposed to. These were people who said, you know, we need to learn how to trust God with our money. And the way that we do that is we just give 10% of everything that we receive from our employment or whatever. And I'm like, we can barely make it. I'm paying tuition out of my own pocket and all this stuff. And they smile and they'd laugh and they go, yeah, that's challenging, huh? Yeah. But you can do it. I'm like, really? It doesn't make sense. But it will. And so, foolishly, my wife and I are like, okay, let's try it. And that was 1982, the summer of 1982. And we just decided to take a step of faith and say, let's do this. We have never been without food, clothing, or shelter. We have never been without the resources to send our kids to school. We have never been without the resources to do anything that we really needed to do in our lives. And over the years, that 10% that we started with has grown as a percentage of our income over time. And I'm so thankful for that. There's a freedom that comes with that. There's a joy that comes to be able to be sacrificial and to give and to see the results of our collaborative investments in the kingdom of God. It's an awesome thing, and you can absolutely do it, and you can do it now. I'm not suggesting that you do exactly what we did, but have a goal. Have a goal, a godly goal that you agree upon in your home before God, and do it. Not just set a goal, follow through with it. Another example would be in the area of the talents that God has given to us. Paul says to Timothy in 2 Timothy 2, that's a very famous passage. He says, the things that you've heard from me, these, he says, entrust to faithful people who will be able to teach others also. And so the trajectory is the things that Timothy has learned from Paul, these become assets. Now at this point, he knows some things that somebody else knows less about. And so he says, take these assets and then train them, teach them, give them these things that I've given to you. And they, for their part, can then go and teach others also. How about finding someone who, yes, is even more ignorant than you in spiritual things? Which you can do, because you're a smart feller. Learn some things. And why not share these things that you have learned and things that you're continuing to learn with someone who knows less? That would be a blessing to them, wouldn't it? It absolutely would. This is God's way, a whole framework, a network of a community of people who are putting into each other's lives in this way the things that we have received, we then turn around and give. And maybe there's mentoring we can do for people who know less. Maybe we can be sort of peer mentors, people who are sort of where we are and have kind of learned the same sorts of things. If you're like me, your spiritual life is kind of like a sieve. A lot goes in, but a lot kind of flows through too. And we need to, how do we retain these things? We need the reinforcement of our brothers and sisters in our lives to help talk to us about the things that we're learning and how do they apply concretely and practically in our lives. And to have those kind of peer relationships, are we praying together on a regular basis, on a weekly basis, see? And reading spiritually rich content that gives us the kind of things to have insight into our lives and to the lives of someone else so that we can grow spiritually together. That would be a great goal. You look around and you say, you know, there's really no one outside of my own household that I can say I have a goal in this person's life just to be a person who can disciple them, who can mentor them, who can give to them things that God has given to me through others that they lack. And every one of us can do that. Every one of us can do that. We ought to be setting goals in this area. Maybe we need to set goals in the area of deepening our skill sets. And so there are things that you are good at that you could be better at. How about that? Some of us have gifts in the area of counseling, insight into people. Those things can always be shaped and honed more effectively. Some of us have gifting in the area of explaining spiritual things, teaching and things like that. Well, there are ways that we can develop those things as well. I try to have a goal every year of a research project that will just kind of take me through the year to put together. As I'm reading the Bible, I'm thinking about something. And so like one year, several years ago, I spent a year reading the book of Isaiah with a commentary on Isaiah from an author who I deeply respect and enjoy. Another year I spent just reading through the narrative of Exodus, chapters 1 through 19. I spent a year doing that, and all the things that implies in terms of the story of the Exodus and how that affects our understanding of the whole Bible and just the various kinds of things. There's no end to what we can do, but we need to have goals. We accomplish things when we have goals set. Isn't that right? You know, if you don't have a goal in mind, you'll hit it every time. And it just is, it's so unsatisfying. How about doing things that we can look to and say, I'm progressing in this area that I value? Well, or how about crossing some bridges that we are afraid to cross? Whether they're across town or across the world. We live in a culture that is profoundly changing. We need, as representatives of Jesus Christ in this city, to form relationships with people who don't look like us, don't have backgrounds like us, because increasingly that's the way it is in this culture. We don't want to become an irrelevant little subculture out there someplace in the city, do we? No, we want to connect with the world, with the city that God has placed us in. That means crossing bridges into refugee communities, into pockets of communities that are underserved by both the church and everything else, and reach out beyond that globally. How about that? How about having some goals in the area of getting outside of myself for the sake of a compelling Christian witness to those who really are underserved by the church in this way? How about that? This is what it means to be faithful as a steward. So I've got a couple things. We're going to come back to this in just about 5 or 10 minutes or whatever it is. I want to talk about a spiritual bucket list. Here's how we're framing it. If you knew that you had exactly 10 years to live, what would you most want to accomplish? It's just too difficult to think about life's purpose when in the back of our minds, it's like, this is the only thing I know, and it seems like it'll go on forever. But it won't go on forever. You are going to die. Okay? And I'm going to die. We're all here. We're all managers who've gotten their pink slips. We're fired. Okay? Now, let's think about this then. If you know that the sand is running through the hourglass, what do you want to accomplish? That is an important question. That may be the most important question that anyone could be asking themselves here tonight. I don't want to just have life carry me along in its wave. I want to be deliberate about my life and the talents that God has given to me. There are things that I think that God wants me to accomplish. Now, that is a way to live the Christian life. That's purposeful, right? Not just kind of following along the thing. My son, when he was 11, was in a soccer league. And my son, like myself, is not super coordinated. And he just wasn't into the whole soccer thing either. But we're like, you know, come on, you got to try something, this kind of thing. You know how that is. And we found a soccer team that had just about everyone on the team that was like him. And which is good because he really fit in. But we noticed that, you know, you get the soccer ball out there and they start kicking it. And what happens to all these kids? Like a cloud, like a flock of birds. They just, you know, surround the ball. And the ball is just getting bounced around in this little thing. And it's not going anywhere. They couldn't get it through their minds that they got to, if they're going to succeed, if they're going to score a goal, they got to fan out, right? And get a little strategery into the situation. And a lot of us are living our lives like the 11-year-old following the cloud of other 11-year-olds around the ball. We're just kind of running where everybody else is running. It's not sharp. It's not direct. And it's not that satisfying either, which is why we kind of tend to be half-hearted about the thing, if we're honest, right? So what about a spiritual bucket list? If you knew you had 10 years and that's all you've got, what would you really want to accomplish? You think about that. And secondly, it goes right with it. How about a resource inventory? A resource inventory. What are three of the most valued resources God has entrusted to you? And what can you do now to put them to work for Him? The three most valued resources God has entrusted to you. What has God entrusted to you? Just, you know, think about that for a second. And what would it look like now to put them to work for Him? And we're going to come back to that. That's awesome. Bernie's back there taking a picture of the screen. This is good. But we're going to deal with that problem, because what we're going to do is we're going to press on, but we're going to keep these questions on the side. We want to come back to these. The last point. No servant, Jesus says, can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the others. You cannot serve God and wealth. Okay. There you go. He's saying be decisive. Choose whom you will serve. The reality is, we are all going to serve, as Dylan said so many years ago, somebody. Right? We're going to either serve the world system and get out of what we can, or we're going to serve the Lord. And that's a different proposition altogether. Something always has the decisive word in our lives. At the end of the day, we're making decisions between alternatives, and one of those alternatives is going to win out. Right? And so that's what Jesus says. He says, you can't say, I'm giving myself to the service of God, but I reserve the right to also serve myself through the just self-interested acquisition of wealth and my stuff. That's not how it works, because now we have a conflict over the question of ownership. Whose stuff is it? Is it yours or is it God? That's a very fundamental question that must get answered in the life of a disciple. And there is a very dangerous reality that we also need to be informed of. And I don't know how you feel about this whole discussion tonight. Most people in our culture feel very uneasy and very uncomfortable with this, because we're loaded in comparison to the rest of the world, even though we've been taught to think that we're really quite poor. But there's a danger here of a culture that is self-deceived about its assets and a Christian spirituality that is brought up in that culture that can't see the forest for the trees. Jesus talked about this in Revelation chapter 3 about the church in Laodicea. He says, because you say, I am rich and I have become wealthy and you've needed nothing. Okay? That's the American ideal, to not need anything, right? I don't need anything. That's the ideal. But Jesus says, in the pursuit of that, you don't know that you're wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. Yeah, because why? Because in the pursuit of wealth, it impoverishes our soul. That's why. That's why. It works against learning how to trust God with our life. It works against surrendering ourselves to His sovereign care and His say-so, His lordship in our life. And these are dangerous things. And so we come right back around to where we left off, and just to say, this is a parable about wealth. This is so at the core of what it means to be a disciple of Jesus Christ, especially in our culture. It's a really important lesson for us.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.